Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Dadcast. I'm your host, JP, joined by the other host, Mr. Nick Martin. Hello, Nick. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you, JP?
I'm real well. Well, aside from a little bit of stress earlier, which we may or may not get into in this episode, everything is just fine and dandy. It's a beautiful Friday here. Today on the show, we are honored and pleased to have a very accomplished actor, voice actor, and of course, today, the most important thing, he is a dad. Welcome to the show, Mr. Greg Ellis. Mr. Ellis, how are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks, JP. How are you, Nick?
I'm good.
Good to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Thanks for taking time out of your, I'm sure, very, very busy schedule to hang out with us regular old dads here on Dadcast. Now, the first and most important question, Greg, well, maybe not most important, but the rite of passage here on Dadcast is, of course, are you a dad?
Yes.
Yes. How many kids do you have?
29.
29. You're right up there.
Yes. I just figured no one's ever answered that before that way. So no, I have two boys.
Two boys. That's pretty impressive. 29 kids. Nick's working on as far as 337, as far as we know at this point.
That's right.
You are a nimble fellow. That's all I can say.
So, how old are your boys?
17 and 14.
17 and 14. Now, I know there's a story to tell regarding your particular case and when it comes to your path and adventure in fatherhood. I'm just going to kind of sit back because I know you and Nick, you parallel each other a little bit when it comes to this story. I'm going to sit back. I'm going to ask you that question. What is that story when it comes to your role as a father and some of the hardships that you have been going through?
Well, hardships. I mean, I write about this in my book, The Respondent. So the hardships was in the span of 20 years married, two young boys. And in the span of 24 hours, I was ushered from my home in handcuffs without cause and incarcerated. First of five incarcerations, subjected to a temporary restraining order in divorce court on the basis of a false allegation. I learned probably too slow, but quick enough eventually that there is no presumption of innocence or due process in the one branch of our legal system that should provide it, and that's family law. Just the myriad of complexities of this state-sanctioned, there's no other way to say it. It sounds a bit hyperbolic, kidnapping or dadnapping. And the way the system is set up, it's biased against fathers and dads, but it's also biased against both parents to find a way out of a legal system where there really isn't, for the most part, a way out. So, you know, I crossed that legal Rubicon. I thought when I entered the court system that I was in America and the justice system, and I'd see a judge and get justice and have integrity. And little did I know I was entering the Star Chamber, where in the Wild West of family law there are no rules. And the sheriffs and the judges are writing their own rules. So that's, I kind of documented that and went through that experience and then created a charity, a charitable extension from my project, The Respondent, called Children and Parents United, which is long form for CPU. And, you know, we have a wonderful board together. We're building out programs and workshops and cost-effective programs and workshops for people to learn how to keep out of court, how to avoid the many divorce traps, and how to have a sustainable marriage. And really, I think part of what I talk about is the mythopoetic, reintroducing the idea that all men aren't bad. We shouldn't necessarily be smashing the metaphorical patriarchy. And rather than talking about toxic femininity as a kind of bulwark for toxic masculinity, we should maybe talk about more positive and heroic forms of masculinity and femininity so we can champion both sexes and all peoples and genders.
Yeah.
That was the best answer to a question I think I've ever had on this Dadcast. And you ain't kidding, man. Unfortunately, this is too common.
Yeah.
No matter. I've been very, very, I wouldn't say lucky, but fortunate that my family life, my lady, my kids, we haven't had to experience anything such as that. But I know many, many friends who have been put.
Exactly. Yeah. I wish I would have come across you about 10 years ago when I was going through all of this. And it's, you're right. I've spent probably $40,000-$50,000 on attorney fees, court fees, dealing with my ex and getting custody of my kids. And after about 9 years, it finally worked out. My daughter came to live with me. My boys stayed with their mom. But it's finally to a point where we've agreed to only talk about the kids and not argue amongst each other anymore and do what's best for them. And the fact that it took 9 years for that, of 9 years of lies and just bashing each other, was terrible. And I wish there would have been a guidebook to guide me through this, other than hiring attorneys saying, well, sorry, you're a guy, you don't have any rights. The mom's going to get all the rights. She's, you know, whether she's a bad person or not, she's still going to get all the rights. And
yeah, we still have this outdated approach to child rearing. Yeah. I mean, you know, mothering and fathering is important and in equal value. And it's the quality of that individual that matters, not necessarily the paradigm of whether you are a woman or a mother or a male and a father. And to your point, the system doesn't offer relief. And many times it doesn't offer relief to the point where you believe you've entered this Kafka trap, this kind of dystopian, authoritarian maze that you're the only one living in. And how can this be? And your world is turned upside down. And I think, you know, when I went through my experience, I reached out and looked for help, and whether it was books or workshops, and there was nothing out there. In fact, the only thing I found on the internet in terms of material and literature was books written by attorneys, you know, for $160 to just kind of, you know, get you into their law firm and be representing you and get the retainer signed and rack up the billable hours. Or for the most part back then, it was books written by women for women on how to ruin your husband, get the cash and prizes of divorce. So there was only one book, and that was Alec Baldwin's book, A Promise to Ourselves, or A Promise to Myself. I think it was Promise to Myself anyway. You know, he was kind enough to write the introduction, the foreword for my book, The Respondent, because I committed to writing that book as a way of paying it forward, as a way of, even if it's there just as a papered beacon, you know, that people can just know that there's someone has gone through what you're going through, as a man, particularly with our cultural conversation that talks about, you know, how we seem to be devaluing men. I mean, the military men that I've spoken to, they're risking their lives fighting in wars away from their families. And I don't know if they do or don't, but let's say hypothetically they don't agree with the war they're fighting. They're still going to fight that war because that's what they signed up for. They return home and they are thrust into this legal system where they have no right. They end up homeless. They're already dealing with PTSD. The layers and levels of trauma and the inescapability of this system on top of that is, I think, is a national health crisis that few people I've seen out there want to talk about. It's a difficult subject, and most people don't really want to think about it until it happens to them. So, yeah, it's a particularly challenging subject.
Yeah, I don't know. For you, did you find, like, when I was talking about it and bringing it up on social media and asking, trying to find advice, I kept getting bashed because, oh, you're talking bad about your ex-wife, you're talking bad about the mother of your children. And it's like, I'm just trying to find answers. I'm trying to figure out my way through this. So I think that's kind of a big stigma too, is it where men go and try to ask for help, or they try to explain what's going on. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, you're just a terrible person because you're bashing the mom.
So it's the oxymoron here, the paradox in this system. And it's really, I focus a lot on the false allegation of domestic violence. Many of the statistics that we see out in the cultural conversation are incorrect, and they're purposefully incorrect for a reason, because this trope of all men are violent and all women are victims. It's very successful in our current cancel culture, where victimhood is the new social currency and its economy is booming. And where victimhood isn't held accountable, responsibility will never follow. So it's really important that we talk about, you know, the real victims of domestic violence, how they get justice. I do believe that domestic violence should be tried in criminal court, not the quasi-kangaroo court of family law, where, you know, the accused actually gets Miranda rights and the right to speak to an attorney, et cetera, but the accuser gets their day in court and alongside a prosecution proves their case in front of a judge or a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a serious offense. But at the same time, when we look at the rates of intimate partner violence, serious intimate partner violence, and it's 48% to 52% male-female, that's pretty much equal in terms of, you know, abuse has no gender. And when we look at the rates of false accusations, it's up there over 70% of false allegations. So what happens to those individuals who are falsely accused, who have been rinsed and washed through the cycle in the system, oftentimes losing their livelihoods, oftentimes losing their ability to even remain connected with their children? These were once loving, present parents. And just because they're fathers and men, they are devalued and they're not as important. No, they are important. We do need, otherwise we're going to have a generation of younger men and boys who are going to be tomorrow's warriors, leaders, politicians, doctors, first responders, teachers, who aren't balanced. We need to have that balance. You know, I spoke with Caitlin Flanagan on my show, and she said it takes a mother to raise a boy, it takes a father to raise a man. And I think that good fathering and being present, and yes, if you're a dad that goes out and earns a living, you know, and you're married to a stay-at-home mom, or the two of you are working, there's so many different, or a stay-at-home dad we hear about a lot these days. How we interpersonally relate with compassion and empathy, and find the best non-helicopter parenting for our children. And I think men and fathers provide that risk, that reward of taking chances and risk, the nature, go out to nature and you explore. And mothers, to a degree, it's that nurturing, you know, little Tommy falls over, mom's like, oh, you okay? And bring them close and hug and nurture. And that dad is like, oh, come on, get back on the horse. Let's get back up after the bad tackle on the pitch and away we go down the field. And that's a good balance, I think, archetypally.
Right.
I agree. Have you navigated your way out of this fight, and when it comes to you personally and your children and that life?
Well, you know, in terms of the psychological warfare, I've become more at ease and accepted much of what happened. I talk about at times, I talk with dads and some mums who are going through this, and I call what they're going through, or they're close to, or they talk about when they have suicidal ideations, suicide by living grief. So there is a definitive point to an end of life. No parent should have to bury their own child. There is a grieving process that one goes through when that happens. But that ambivalent grief, that living grief of how you comprehend that almost insurmountable sadness, stricken with a deep sense of loss of the most important meaning of your life, can be too much for many parents to bear. And then you add on top of that the system that pulls you into court where attorneys make arguments. So have I managed to end? Well, I guess, you know, at the end of the day, the war ends with self, you know, with a truce with yourself. So whatever others decide to do, whether they continue to, you know, rally the troops and send the cavalry in, you wave the white flag and it's still not ending. You can at least find, there are ways. I mean, I write this in this, I have a free downloadable ebook called The Code, which for people who read The Respondent, they can download that for free, the website. And that's really immediate interventions into well-being, both philosophical and phenomenological, kind of emotional tips, if you will, if you find yourself in this situation, that will really help somatically calm the organism, self-regulate the self, not legal advice, because good grief, I'm not an attorney, thank goodness.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, to talk about the cavalry's coming in, you know, when I was younger, I thought the cavalry was coming, and then I got older and realized I was the cavalry. And you know, sometimes you know the cavalry that isn't always charging into battle. You have to know when to unsheath the sword and when to tend to the horses, and you know, just retreat.
Look at that analogy right there, Nick. Huh?
Yeah. Wow.
I ain't gonna lie, Greg Ellis. Typically, I lead all these podcasts, but you are one of the smartest guys I've talked to with the big words. And yeah,
big words. What big words have I used?
Oh, a ton of them. Yeah. Do you see your boys very often?
I don't see my boys anymore.
Okay, that was a question I did not know. I couldn't even imagine.
Yeah,
that sucks. I'm very, very sorry to see that.
Thanks, guys. Well, look, you know what? I wasn't able to effectuate change enough, even though I fought for six years nearly. You know, when you're up against, I did Dr. True Pinsky's show recently, and I talked about the panic disorder that my ex-wife suffered through when she wasn't on medication. He said, I don't know about panic disorder, it sounds like psychopathy. So I think when you are faced with, the original title for my book, oh, maybe this will make you chuckle, was How to Survive When Your Spouse Wants You Dead and Has the Legal Ways and Means to Kill You. Because it's a survival guide.
It's a little wordy.
Well, it, yeah, it's a bit long.
It'll take up the entire cover.
Right. but, you know, I mean, look, the crazy thing about the system is, and why, you know, what, another reason I wrote the book is I didn't want to write the book. I had to. I wrote it to make sense of the government-sponsored devastation of mine and thousands of families' lives and the destruction of family. I think we need more family champions. Mm-hmm. I wrote to let my kids know that I hadn't abandoned them. I had to memorialize it somehow because I didn't get a voice in court. I wrote to tell other similarly situated men and fathers and often women and mothers too, that they're not alone. And perhaps most of all, I wrote it to ring the alarm bell about a broken system and right. call for social change and family law reform and improvement.
Now, is there, you know, they're going to be adults here soon. Is there any chance of reconciliation here in a few years when it comes to that?
Well, there's always a look. My door is wide open for, you know, I didn't ever close my door. I was shoved away.
Let me rephrase. Do you think on their side? I mean, granted, you can't talk to them. You don't know. But I guess deep down, is there that? No, there has to be that hope. Is it possible in a few years that everything's going to be better?
I think no family is perfect. Even families that are intact, if you will, there is always some dysfunctional functioning or insecure functioning or insecure dysfunctionality. I don't know. You know, families of origin are tricky and prickly and relationships are tough and communication's hard. But I think one of the most pernicious aspects of family law is... And this corresponds to families as well that are intact, not just going through the divorce quagmire or come out the other end, is parental alienation, also known as turning the child. It's an umbrella term that it details a series of actions or behaviors with the malicious intent to have the children hate a once beloved parent. And that's the key, a once beloved parent. And those signs of parental alienation are multitudinous and varied. The presence of a prior positive relationship between the child and the then becoming or now rejected parent. The absence of maltreatment or seriously deficient parenting. Lack of ambivalence in the child's view, i.e. seeing one parent as all good and the other as all bad. These are all aspects of loyalty and betrayal that the young psychological adolescent mind, as it's growing and forming through experience and reflective mirroring, is cementing in its foundational core belief system. And that fear-based mentality, that lack of trust, the insecurity of boundaries that gets instilled in a core belief system can have really damaging effects and lasting effects through 20s, 30s, 40s, and sometimes for the rest of one's life. So what I talk about and why I talk about it through the lens of my story and what happened to me. And by the way, I'm not an angel. You know, I made mistakes and I put my mistakes in the book too. I have flaws. It's just tomorrow I vow to make better mistakes. I think we can all come together. And for men, I think it's particularly difficult because we're sold on this canard that we have to be stoic and hold our feet, grow up, be a man, boys don't cry. Yeah. And I think there is an aspect of that that I can see that where there's some merit to that, depending on the age of the child and the experience of the child and whether they're confident and outgoing or insecure and a bit of a loner, or they feel like they're being left behind. But at the same time, why not talk about our feelings and emotions? You know, it's okay to say. I wish there were one day on social media where we could all kind of shut everything down and everyone could just be honest rather than presenting the best version they can invent of themselves. And we can all just, you know, we can all seek our 15 minutes of anonymity rather than fame and just be honest.
I think you just hit the new billion-dollar idea, Greg. It can be the anti-social media where we do the exact opposite and project the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
People would take it up though. You know, we can try though. We can certainly try.
I often talk about anti-social media and the reverse psychology embedded in the algorithm of these big tech platforms at inception, and how device dependency has got hold of us. And I think it's very difficult for all of us, but particularly maybe for younger generations who have grown up in the age of modernity and the age of technology. To be able to put down the device, step away from the screen, actually be in person, be with people or be in nature and just look around rather than, I think many of us have these devices in front of us and we're exercising from the eyes down rather than the neck up, you know, and that neck up business of, you know, meditation and how we find relief with sometimes the unbearable suffering of being, which it can be. I believe everyone's struggling with something. Even those we look up, we go, oh gosh, look at that. Their lives are amazing. Look there. I see them at film shoots and celebrities and this, that, and the rest of it. Everyone's struggling with something.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, and when it comes to social media, yeah, I'm guilty too. I project the happy times, the good times when something real special just happened with my daughter and myself or my son or both of them. And most recently, Halloween. We posted the Halloween pictures. We're trick-or-treating. Everything's great and dandy. But, you know, I didn't decide to film this morning when I had to yank my daughter out of bed from her legs because after asking her to wake up 15 times, she wouldn't do so. And then the ensuing crying fit that happened afterwards. And don't get me wrong, it wasn't abusive. It was a gentle pull. We just had to get her on her feet so she was awake. But yeah, that just doesn't really reflect well on social media in the backlash. You can imagine with, as you mentioned earlier, all the people in the cancel culture and everyone wants to come out and the trolls and attack me for, how could you do such a thing to your daughter? Man, we just got to get to school. But yeah. I'm thinking I might actually do that here and there, Nick, and we'll see what happens. A little social.
I don't know. I'd be careful. Like, so when I was going through all the initial, my ex-wife took the kids, I didn't see them. I was posting honest, truthful crap on social media and getting bashed for it. And, you know, posts were getting deleted by Facebook because of the negativity in it. Oh, so it's kind of, does it work? Maybe. Do people care? No, I think people want to see the happy stuff. They don't want to believe that everybody's going through crap and stuff at different times in their lives. So I don't know.
Some humor on it.
Yeah. I think what you explained this morning would be actually kind of hilarious. Was it the younger daughter or the older daughter?
I definitely wasn't yanking a 17-year-old out of her bed. Okay,
I've had to yank my 17-year-old out of bed. It's not fun. And
Greg, this may come as strange, awkward, and maybe not even wanted on your end from me, but I'm going to propose it anyway for you. And it's not a sympathy move at all, but I am officially making you an honorary dad of my children.
Wow.
So if and when we need to send him for summer camp or something, I'm going to send him to Greg Ellis's house and you can get your dad time.
Oh, in. I didn't. No, hang on. Do I get a say in this?
Of course you do.
So we can negotiate terms.
Yes, absolutely. Terms.
Can I interview the kid first? I mean, the interview might be at a fun place, like, you know, a fun adventure park, or, you know, I don't know. But, you know, it's not really an interview. But gosh, all joking aside, because I know
first time. We'll do it together the first time. Make sure everyone's happy. You know, but you know, there you go. There's the offers on the table.
Do you know what's important is it's, you know, we joke, but it is important, the extended family, the friends, the uncles. You know, growing up in Northern England where I grew up, you know, even friends of my parents who weren't bloodline, if you will, we called them uncle and auntie, you know, because they were just, they felt like family. And I think, you know, blood makes you related, but loyalty makes you family. And these loyal people that were around us were like Uncle so-and-so and Auntie so-and-so. So mentorship as well. I think we've lost our way with that, with some of the organizations we've seen, you know, falling into controversy. I forget which is the correct colloquialism, being English and American. You know, with the Boy Scouts and, you know, even the Catholic Church and just places of faith and meaning and fellowship and connection. And this propensity to just be divisive and derisive and find the worst thing about someone else and push to the extreme and getting, you know, hyper political about issues. And we should really be, I think, finding more ways to kind of knit back the tapestry of our collective community and how we can find and empower the best in people, because everyone has that potential to be good and better.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I found in at least in my life, community, they come together, and especially family too, under tragic instances. 9/11. Look what happened to, I mean, at least the United States during this time, and even my small neck of the woods where I lived. It took a tragic event to bring everyone together. And under tragic events, it was nice for a few years there. Everyone got along. They believed in the same thing. And if they didn't, they weren't fighting each other over it. And right. I just find that sad. I mean, do we need to have some tragic to make things good again? How do we navigate and get to that community, especially for family and even, you know, the parents and the parents of other kids? And how do we do that? How does it happen? Because in the history of life, it hasn't happened yet. You know, we get little fits of it, but it's just sad. It's
especially the last couple of years have been really bad with separation. And
but we don't want to get political. We can if we want, but yeah, I mean, the political landscape is just everyone. I'm not left. I'm not right. I think everyone should be right in the middle or do their best to get to that point without killing each other and fighting over it. But we don't need to go there unless you want to go there. But I mean, I did the deep dive on the Wikipedia on you, Greg, and I know your stance. So we don't, you know.
I don't even know what it says on Wikipedia. This sandwich, like, I have opinions on quite a lot of stuff, you know.
And I'm Ellis has been a controversial figure in the fan base, having been a vocal supporter of, may I?
Yo, you say whatever you want.
Donald Trump, Jordan Peterson, and Charlie Kirk. Wikipedia, it says it right there.
See, well, there you go. Like that. How wrong is that? So not. Let me preface this by saying that you know, I have my own personal beliefs, but you know, we live in America where anyone's entitled to, you know, support and champion and cast their vote for whoever they like. And I'm not. I don't subscribe to the whole, you know, 48 million people, half the population are bad people because they vote one way or the other. But just let me set the record straight. I didn't even know that was on there.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, it's Wikipedia. You can edit it yourself.
Oh, well, there we go. so actually, it's quite humorous to actually, like, I'm a controvert. Like, I wonder who wrote that. No, I've never been a supporter, vocal or otherwise, of former President Trump. I'm not a subscriber to the Orange Man Bad Trump Derangement Syndrome, where everything in the world that's possibly wrong in my personal life through to, national politics is down to that one individual. I think I wrote once that I respect the office of the president. I don't necessarily need to like the person or agree with the policies of the person who's in office, but I'm always going to be respectful. I love America. I love the traditions of America. I think the Constitution is just an astonishing document. The founding fathers who wrote it were just, in that time and that context, astounding people. But see, this is where it's, the cancel culture today is, if you don't agree with some of the extreme far left postmodern progressive ideology, with like the AOCs of the world, rather than the moderates, if you don't agree with that ideology, which is very extreme, then you're immediately tossed to the other side as alt-right and neo-Nazi and et cetera. It's a reductivism to the highest order. On my show, I invited one of the leading members of Antifa and one of the leading members of Proud Boys on. Why? Do I agree with either of their ideologies? No, of course I don't. But unless we bring extremes together to have conversations as individuals, we're just going to be perpetrating more and more hatred, more and more division, and more negativity. So, Jordan Peterson, he's a very interesting fellow, and I think he's done a lot of good for a lot of people. That's all I'll say on that. So I have vocally spoken about him. Charlie Kirk, I've never mentioned. I think I may have. I think he's the Turning Point USA fellow who gets into it with people on the ideological left and right. Who knew politics? Who knew that some random person knew what I was thinking? I didn't realize. I have to get them out of my mind.
Yeah, get them out of there. Oh, that's the beauty of Wikipedia. I can go in there right now and type up that J.P. Pierce was right alongside you, co-starred in Pirates of the Caribbean with you, and no one will know the difference.
It's bizarre. What's bizarre as well is that, I've rarely talked about politics, if ever, before 2018, I think. And I publicly endorsed Andrew Yang in his presidential run as a registered Democrat. I got behind him. I was somewhat vocal about Tulsi Gabbard too, but I was looking for a Democrat that wasn't running on the identity politics ticket, because I think identity politics eventually devours itself. And, Andrew, I got to know, and I was a fervent supporter of his. So isn't that interesting? No mention of that. No mention of my relationship with Andrew Yang, but apparently I'm a vocal supporter of President Trump.
I can literally edit it right now, but when
I've got a back
on Andrew Yang. You have my permission. We can do that live on air. If you know what to do, then sure. What's it under politics?
Wikipedia, you got your career, politics, filmography, references, and external links. I find it surprising there's not much personal life. Most people, especially someone of your caliber, and you're very, very popular fella, that section is on there. Nothing. I mean, and you'd think, especially with what you've gone through, what you are going through, the books you have written on the topics, that would be in there. It is not. So maybe I'll spend some time today and add that, and I will take it directly from this very interview, so you can know, people out there, when you see that section on the Wikipedia, JP was telling the truth.
There you go. Thank you. Yeah, I guess I should check things like that. But, people are going to write what they're going to write, and they're going to make up stuff. But the thing is, it does get pernicious. It does spread like a sulfuric miasma as people start believing, really, he is. Oh, he did. Yes, he did. Well, God, hate him. Don't like him. I mean, good grief. It's so easy to fall into those anti-social media traps. I've been called a few names just because I have, expressed support for a couple of people based on a particular opinion or a particular action that they've taken. Like, one was J.K. Rowling. She was posting all these wonderful artistic drawings by 7, 8, and 9-year-olds on social media. And I thought that was just so lovely to just shine a light on children in that artwork. And Ayaan Hirsher Ali is another. She escaped an oppressive Islamic state. She'd had genital mutilation. She found her way to Holland, was a janitor, and then became a member of parliament. What an amazing, empowering story about a woman. So I just said, I support them both. The next thing you know, I was a transphobe. I was a racist. I was, you name it. And, you know, I'm like, what? Hang on a second. How do you know what I think?
Oh, it's the internet.
Yeah.
Duh. Let's switch gears here. I've got a personal question that I'm curious about because, well, a little backstory here. I work in radio, been working in radio for the last 20 years, mostly rock and roll radio, but I have done some voiceover work in my day. And I know you, sir, are a superstar when it comes to voiceover talent over 100 different video games and all kinds of things. Where and how did you get your start doing voiceover work?
I think it was around maybe 20 years ago. I was having a conversation with my manager at the time. I'd been doing film and TV, and she just said to me, "Have you ever done voiceover?" And I said, "What's that?" And she said, "Oh, it's, you know, you do cartoons and you can do animation, you can do animated feature films and commercials and promos." And I said, "Well, what does it entail? Like, what do you do?" And she said, "Well, if it's a cartoon, you would, you know, make up your, you would interpret the character breakdown for a voice and a character on a cartoon show and go and record." I said, "I can do that." And then, of course, she followed up with, "Well, it's not that easy. It's kind of a closed shop. It's, you know, you need to be uber talented, and there's not that many opportunities." And I often have the what I call the koyashi mentality. It's a Japanese word for inspiration from negative feedback. So if someone says, "You can't do that," or "It's hard to do that," or "You won't achieve that," internally I say to myself, "You want to bet?" Or I say to that person internally, "You want to bet? Just watch me." And so I went in. I said, "Set me up a meeting." I went into a meeting at one of the, I'd say probably the top three or four voiceover talent agencies here in Hollywood. And I had no demo reel prepared. I had nothing prepared whatsoever. And I just sat in this office with, I think it was about seven or eight agents. I remember it being a small office. It was the partner's office. And we just chatted, and I just inserted dialects and voices and characters along the way, and then said that because I had one more meeting to go to, I said, "You know, I had a great meeting, thank you. I'm going to head over to so-and-so competitor," I forget the name, and I literally walked out of the office, and my manager called and said, "Turn around and go back in, they want to sign you." I said, "Well, we've got another meeting set up." And then I kind of realized that one of the things you want to do when people are excited to work with you, yes, it's fine if you want to go away and have a meeting and take a beat to think about it. Sometimes you do need to do that. But I don't think you should leave it too long because people's enthusiasm in the moment as they want to get to work with you and get things motivated and moving along can wane if you wait too long. So, yeah, so I signed with them, and then I ended up, it was actually a comic book that I read as a kid. This is one of the cool aspects of doing voiceover, was I used to read this comic book called Dan Dare, Pilot of the Future. And similar kind of character in a way to Buck Rogers, but rather more British and well-spoken, you know, and hopeful and chip-chip muckles. And, well, yes, Dan Dare, Pilot of the Future. Yes, come on, my Zonda, we're going to see the Mekon. You know, all of that kind of business. And I actually got the role of Dan Dare, which was my first animated series. So that was just, and then I found out that the creator of Dan Dare was born in my hometown, and there's a little monument that they've put up to him. So yeah, it's been a wonderful ride through. I love the voiceover community. They're just such a great group of people. It's pretty small, you know, we all tend to know each other. And look, we get to go to places like Cartoon Network and Nickelodeon and, you know, sit in a studio and play, literally make up voices. And yeah. Sometimes it's two or three voices from, you know, on this, we're doing a scene, and I might be playing three characters, and I'm voicing all three characters in the scene with myself. So I have to switch from back and forth. And the fans as well, I think, you know, particularly in video games, they've been wonderful. At times the fandom can get a bit similar to our current cultural conversation a bit. The loudest, noisiest minority can tend to be a bit mobby, you know, and right. and judgmental. But yeah, it's been great. VoiceOver's been wonderful.
So what is that ad agency particular that you had that meeting with that they loved you? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, because JP needs to get down there.
Oh, it wasn't an ad agency. It was a voiceover talent.
Voiceover talent, yes.
Yeah, they're no longer. It was TGI was the name of the talent agency, and they've since they had a voiceover talent department and commercials, on camera commercials as well. And they were, maybe special artists before that. And then they disbanded and the agents went different ways. So one, I believe, went to, but one of them set up their own voiceover agency, which has become one of the three or four biggest agencies here in town. And another one went to another agency and became a partner at that particular agency. But there are really, I'd say, probably four or five of the big agencies and maybe a smattering of boutique agencies that represent people. Yeah. But yeah.
That's amazing. Cause you're a global phenomenon voice. Myself and Nick can attest to this. I've got about 150 square mile radius here in Southern Oregon. Everyone knows my voice here. You know, been working on radio, but we gotta get a little bit bigger. Okay, putting Greg on the spot. Do your best Southern California American accent. Go.
Well, it depends. I mean, what do you want to call me? I was like totally awesome. Oh. I was like, so gnarly, you know, and everything. And I speak in the same monotone.
I didn't say homosexual, but that worked.
Yeah, but I went there. I just made a character choice. I mean, why? Just because I'm effeminate doesn't mean I'm... Well, why do you say I'm homosexual?
Well, you know, the shoe fits. The voice, at least. Very good. Very good. All right. Okay. You got one, Nick?
I don't.
All right. Sorry. So voiceover work, man, I'm just so happy to be sitting here talking with you. Should we talk, Nick, the film career? I was hoping to stay away from this, not because it's not interesting. It's because, I mean, I'm assuming, Greg, with every interview you've ever done, it always ends up leading this and people want to talk about Pirates of the Caribbean and Titanic and all the television stuff you've done. I love sticking with the dad stuff and your book. And all the stuff you're doing, fighting for all that. You're a busy guy. Uh-oh.
I apologize. My ringer is turned off, but for some reason it is zinging away. Oh, and that's why, because it's on my... there we go. I apologize for all of those listeners who heard that ring-a-ting-ting-ting.
Is it on your iMac too? Yeah, I had to turn mine off. I forgot that.
That was what got me.
Nick, it's okay. Nick, I'm giving you the conch for a sec.
For what? What are we doing?
You were very interested. You want to talk movies.
Yeah, I do. I want to. So Star Trek, you were in the remakes, right? The updated versions.
Yes.
I love those movies. Tell me about your experience. Is there another one coming?
My experience on Star Trek. So, anecdotes. Let's see. I played in the 2009 movie, Chief Engineer Olsen, the original engineer of the Enterprise. And I remember having my wardrobe fitting and Chris Pine was in I think he was in yellow and John was in blue. No, Chris was in blue and John was in yellow and I was in red. And I didn't know I'd appeared in the season finale episodes of Deep Space Nine, but I just didn't know the folklore of the red shirt. So when JJ saw me, he's like, pretty cool, man. So, you know, you get to wear the red shirt or the red skydive suit. And I'm like, yeah, red. I love, you know, great color. And he's like, yeah. And you die like them all. I'm like, well, yeah, what do you mean like them all? He said, oh, the law. And he told me about the lore of it. And then he joked and said, you know, don't be too despondent. You know, Chief Engineer Olsen may come back. Well, maybe we'll bring you back and we won't have you in an obvious red shirt and you'll die and you can be the Olsen twin. And I think he was making some kind of joke, but about the Olsen twins. And then we were talking about accent and dialect. I never thought that Chief Engineer Olsen in the Star Trek movie would end up with a Northern Yorkshire or Leeds accent. But that came about simply through a conversation that I had on SEG. JJ asked me, you know, literally said, so what are you thinking in terms of the backstory of the character and where he's from and some of the history? And I just opened my mouth to speak. And Chris Pine, who was close by listening in, says, he's from Leeds, isn't he? He's like, right, from Leeds. And he did the most amazing Leeds accent. And I was like, and I was a bit taken aback. And JJ goes, Leeds, to me. I go, yeah, he's actually really bloody good at that. He's like talking like from Leeds all the time, very in your face, very like clipped in here. And I was just started talking and JJ went, that's it, great, he's from Leeds. I went, well, okay. So that's how sometimes those kinds of decisions are made. But it, yeah, it was a very secretive set. We would travel to set in golf carts there were, well, you couldn't see in because the paparazzi, everything was kind of secret and coded. And I remember filming at Paramount and we literally had to travel about 60 yards from the trailers to the set, which was in the car park out there, the parking lot, as it's called, with mirrors on the ground as we filmed this scene, which was quite cool. Just I got lowered onto the mirrors, looking up, and the camera shot down, but the reflection was of the sky, so it wasn't CGI. It was actually just clever use of mirrors. While JJ was shaking the camera, and I was looking up, going 200 meters or whatever, and we literally got into the Pope Mobile, as we called it, like all covered and in Oscar, and drove for about in this golf cart for about 15 seconds, and then got out. And John Cho was like, well, that was worth it, wasn't it? Great, we've got that security, because it really didn't matter because then we were out in the open, so people were taking photographs anyway. It was a wonderful movie to be part of. I was more of a Star Wars person than Star Trek before then, and still kind of, well, I don't know, I haven't worked that one out in terms of that kind of, that impressed me. The movie impressed me. I thought the script was very impressive, and because there's a tendency, or I had felt up until that point, that movies like Star Trek were kind of really for the fandom and the in crowd. And unless you knew the lore and the history, you couldn't really take part as on an equal playing field as others, and or a more equal playing field in terms of experience. But I think that movie really addressed some of that. It honored some of the folklore of Star Trek, a lot of the folklore, redefined some of it. And I thought the opening sequence in particular was just so phenomenal.
It was a great movie. Yeah, I was afraid it was going to be a little too soap opery and kind of little too just rom-com. And J.J. Abrams did a great job with keeping it true to the originals. And
he's a wonderful director, a lovely fellow, and really has a great vision. And he's so smart, knows what he's doing.
So my question as far as this is concerned is, one of my, I'm looking at your list here. I'm looking at the Wikipedia again. And by the way, Wikipedia got the Star Trek right. You nailed it. It had your name, your cast, and the year correctly. So applaud whoever decided to do that. You were in Dexter. What role did you play in Dexter? Because this is like one of my favorite shows. It's actually coming back.
Yeah.
The new season starts literally in like a week or two.
Yeah, it's actually directed, the series director, I don't think he directs every episode, but his series director is Sanford Bookstaver, who's a friend of mine. And Clancy Brown is a good friend of mine. He's in the cast of the new Dexter. So what character did I play? I think his name was Jonathan Farrow, the first innocent victim of Dexter, by the way. Oh. I'm going to spoil it for people who want to watch the episode, but it's been out for a while, so I might as well say.
Years later. I think we're good.
Yeah, I think so too. I get chopped into the machete treatment on the neck and slain in that way, as I've been wrapped in the, what's it called, cling film or cellophane or naked, which was interesting filming that scene. I'm particularly, you know, rehearsing in my trailer and John Lithgow walking in, mistaking my trailer for his, and I'm lying on the floor naked rehearsing a scene.
That's a true story.
Yeah. So first innocent victim, he kills me and then realizes at the end of the right at the very end of the episode that I wasn't the killer after all. It was my assistant, my character's assistant, and how we joked about my ghost coming back in the imagination of Dexter to haunt him. because he killed, at least he could justify it, that he was doing some kind of vigilante good for society, however dark and his serial killer mind was. But you couldn't do that with an innocent victim. I didn't deserve to die. I may have been, my character may have been morally, you know, abhorrent and objectionable. It was tough filming those scenes at the nightclub with three women, scantily clad, you know, climbing all over me.
Yeah, it's not real difficult.
Well, it's, you know, we have to endure a lot as actors. So
I dressed up as Dexter, and my lady was a victim for Halloween a few years back. And I kid you not, and I have pictures to prove it, we wrapped her up in cellophane, and that was it. And we went out and partied. But it was enough cellophane to, you know, do its job so we could go out in public. But, yeah, we were a hit that year, man. Actually, let me rephrase. She was a hit that year. I was just, you know, the guy that was hanging on her elbow. Like you had per normal. All right. He is Mr. Greg Ellis, a warrior, a champion for fatherhood and parental rights. What was the name of that book one more time for everyone watching and listening to this episode? And any other information as far as this episode is going to generate a lot of buzz. I know it is, at least for the people who watch it on our end. And I want them, I want them to go and do everything they can to get all the information they can from you,
yeah,
to help them out, because, you know, like Nick said, he wishes he had you 10 years ago. And I guarantee there's someone out there right now listening to this, watching this episode, who's like, I need the man's help, or at least the advice. Where do we go?
Well, yeah, well, first of all, if there is anyone out there going through this, you're not alone. That's all I would say. And even though it feels like it's completely hopeless at times, they're just waves of existential angst and terror sometimes. Ride that wave. If you're not going through it, but you suspect you know someone who is, reach out to them. You might just save a life, or at least you'll just maybe make someone's mouth turn a little more upward, which I think we all need a bit more of. The Respondent is the name of the book. The Respondent, Exposing the Cartel of Family Law. I have Johnny Depp was kind enough to write the introduction to the book. Alec Baldwin wrote the foreword. TheRespondent.com, you can find there all of the information about my book, the audio book that comes out on December 7th, my episodes, video and podcast series for The Respondent. There is information on my nonprofit, which is the charitable extension of The Respondent. That's called CPU, or Children and Parents United. And our mission with CPU is really to promote and improve child well-being by providing information, resources, and programs to policymakers, legislatures, practitioners, and mainly the general public, resulting in enhanced relationships and reduced conflict for those children and parents navigating our current family law systems. And we have three main areas that we focus on: CPU communication, mediation, and law. So how can we better communicate so that we don't have to go into mediation? How do we mediate through our differences, through, you know, resolving conflict disputes? And if you really feel like there is no alternative and you want to end a union, then we have a legal team that will help draft up and draw up that settlement agreement. And ultimately, all three of these programs are to keep people out of court, and the inescapability of attorneys' billable hours, and just the dysfunctionality and the unfairness within the legal system.
There you have it. Mr. Greg Ellis, movie star, TV star, voice actor, and champion warrior. You're a warrior. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day and talking with two dads from Oregon on Dadcast. Much appreciated. You're amazing. Again, we have a date with my children at some theme park sometime in the future. I'm not sure if you committed to that, but that's what I heard earlier.
And you might want to ask them about that first.
One of them actually my oldest just walked in. She just got out of school. I don't know if you saw me. You're doing the pitch there. And I told her to come here, and she's like, she panicked. And she's the best looking one of the bunch too. We're talking like 5'10" supermodel stuff. I am in serious trouble. Trust me. But yes, we will have to clear it through them as well. Nick, you got anything, man?
Oh, thank you, man. This was amazing. This was like so much good information. And I, you know, like you said, if anybody's out there and needs help, ask.
There you go.
There is hope. You're not alone. You're right.
And to everyone listening and watching, thank you very much. If you are watching this on the YouTube channel, please subscribe, like, comment, do all the good stuff. And I will link below all the information, all the links I can that Mr. Greg Ellis just talked about. And we'll see you all next week. Have a great rest of your day.